or whatever it is.
Good morning. We'll go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session Thursday, April 25th, 2013, to consider the matter entitled Mock Mining LLC versus Secretary of Labor, docket number Lake 2009-324-R. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Nakamura. We will start with an overview of this case presented by Stacey Dempster. Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners. Mock Mining, LLC, operates the Mock No. 1 mine near Johnston City, Illinois. On February 12, 2009, Entry Inspector Bobby Jones conducted a regular quarterly inspection of the Mock No. 1 mine. While conducting the inspection, Jones examined the primary escapeway at Headgate No. 4. At the mouth of Headgate No. 4 was an 11-foot tall regulator containing a 4-foot, 4-inch wide, and 6-foot tall hole or opening that controls the air into the mine. This opening must be traversed by miners when using the primary escapeway. Located within the escapeway is a lifeline that runs from the fan at the surface of the mine to the loading point. While in the escapeway, Inspector Jones observed numerous hazardous conditions dispersed over 100 to 120 feet of the travelway. These conditions included a pallet of crib ties, a take-up track, a pile of gobs, concrete blocks on both sides of the regulator, and water on the floor. Jones then inspected the weekly examination logs and discovered that there was no record made of the hazardous materials located in the escapeway. The pallet of crib ties, the take-up track, the pile of gobs, and the concrete blocks have been present in the escapeway since January 6, 2009, when the regulator was created. Mock began its weekly examinations of the primary escapeway at Headgate No. 4, 5 weeks prior to Jones's inspection. Company line examiner Dave Adams was assigned the task of conducting the weekly examinations for hazardous conditions from January 8, 2009 through February 12, 2009, the date of the inspection. During this time, Adams did not record any hazardous conditions in the examination records. Prior to the entry inspection, the last weekly examination performed by Adams was approximately 3 days earlier. As a result of what Inspector Jones observed, he issued two citations. The first citation, number 841-4211, alleged a significant and substantial, or SNS, violation of 30 CFR section 75.380D1, which requires that escapeways be maintained in a safe condition to always assure passage of anyone. The second citation, number 841-4214, the subject of this case, alleged an SNS violation of 30 CFR section 75.364H, which requires that hazardous conditions are recorded during weekly examinations. Jones designated this citation an unwarrantable failure. Mock had not been previously cited for the existence of materials in the escapeway. Mock contested the citations and the matters proceeded to hearing before Judge Abram Weisberger. The judge held separate hearings and issued separate decisions on the two citations. On February 24, 2010, the judge issued a decision affirming the first citation, number 841-4211, and the SNS designation. Mock did not appeal this decision. On September 27, 2010, the judge issued his decision on the remaining citation, number 841-4214, affirming section 75.364H, affirming the section 75.364H violation. Significant to his finding of a violation was the combination of the pallet crib ties, pickup track, pile of gob, loosely strewn concrete blocks on either side of the regulator, and the presence of water, which he reasoned would hinder and delay the emergency evacuation of minors, especially injured minors. In addition, the judge noted that despite the presence of the items in the escapeway for 5 weeks, Adams failed to note any of the conditions in his weekly report. The judge also affirmed MSHA's S&S designation. He determined that a reasonably serious injury was reasonably likely to occur because the combination of accumulated items in the escapeway created a stumbling and tripping hazard and would impede a prompt evacuation in an emergency, especially in the presence of smoke and low visibility. The judge, however, found that Mock's negligence did not rise to the level of unwarrantable failure. While applying the relevant unwarrantable failure factors established by the commission, the judge found three factors that unquestionably weigh in favor of finding of Mock's unwarrantable failure. Specifically, he determined that the violative condition was extensive due to the combination of the various accumulated materials that extended over 100 to 120 feet of the escapeway, that the existence of the unreported hazardous conditions in the escapeway for 5 weeks prior to it being cited was an extensive period of time, and that the failure to record the hazardous conditions posed a high degree of danger for the same reasons he found the violation to be S&S. In contrast to the factors weighing in favor of an unwarrantable failure, the judge found that Mock had not previously been cited for an obstructed escapeway and had not otherwise been notified by MSHA that greater compliance efforts were necessary. He then concluded that because Mock lacked prior notice of greater compliance, its abatement efforts relate to its good faith belief that the accumulated items were not hazardous. Additionally, although the judge acknowledged that the existence of the cited material was patently obvious, he found Adams' testimony that he in good faith believed that the cited material did not constitute a hazardous condition to be credible and objectively reasonable under the circumstances. The judge ultimately concluded that, considering the lack of notice from MSHA, the level of Mock's negligence is mitigated regarding what it reasonably should have known concerning the existence of a hazard. The secretary subsequently filed a petition for discretionary review, challenging the judge's finding of no unwarrantable failure, which the commission had granted. The secretary argued that the judge erred in finding that the hazardous condition was neither known to Mock nor obvious because Mock had a good faith belief that the known condition was not hazardous. He also asserts that it was error for the judge to find that Mock's good faith belief was reasonable under the circumstances simply because MSHA did not provide prior notice of the violative condition. The secretary contends that to determine whether Mock knew that its escapeway was not being maintained in a safe manner, the judge was required to consider whether a reasonably prudent person familiar with the protected purpose of the standard would have ascertained that the specific condition at issue was prohibited. The secretary further argues that the judge erred in failing to identify which individual unwarrantable failure factors he found important and the relative weight he attached to the various factors. Mock responds that the judge properly found that Mock reasonably believed that the conditions observed did not violate the law and that it did not unwarrantably fail to comply. It maintains that it was never provided notice that this type of material in an escapeway constituted an obstruction. Specifically, prior to February 12, 2009, Mock had not received a single citation from MSHA for obstructions in or inadequate examinations of its escapeways, nor had there been any discussions regarding such violations at the quarterly closeout conference with MSHA or between Inspector Jones and any Mock personnel. It also states that the same conditions existed at Headgate Number 3 during two previous quarterly inspections in which it did not receive citations. Mock asserts that the conditions found in the escapeway at Headgate Number 4 are common in mines when a regulator is created. It further contends that the judge correctly found Adams' belief objectively reasonable because based on Adams' experience, the conditions were not hazardous because a lifeline was accessible to minors and a clear walking path existed along the rib line. Mock maintains that there was nothing present in that area that was not present throughout the mine. The issue on review is whether the judge erred in finding that Mock's significant and substantial violation of Section 75.364H was not the result of its unwarrantable failure to comply with the regulations. At this point, I'll be happy to take any questions from the commissioners.
Thank you, Stacy. Are there any questions at this point?
No.
And I think, am I correct? Mike, you were going to start off?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to thank Stacy for discussing this case with me and having everything well organized and having a clear grasp of the record. That was very helpful to me. And I'd also like to thank the Chairman's Counsel, Liz Simons, who prepared a very useful memorandum for us in this case. We didn't get a decisional memorandum, and it was very helpful to get some additional background in the law. I greatly appreciated that. We've been careful to point out to our judges the importance of weighing all of the factors in an unwarrantable failure analysis, and so I would hate for anything that we do to be taken as a per se rule marginalizing some factors, but some combinations are pretty much insurmountable. And when you look at the three that that Stacy spotlighted there, if someone were to just tell you, here's a situation, you have a condition that's extensive, that's existed for a period of 5 weeks, so it's a prolonged period of time, and it posed a high degree of danger. These are all things the judge found. If that's not an unwarrantable failure, I don't know what is, if you don't report that. And we have to bear in mind what we're talking about here. This is the requirement that the operator make the inspection of the mine and make sure that the escapeways are safe for travel. And in this case, operator failed to do that. And when you look at the types of conditions that were observed there, it is possible that the judge might have looked at this evidence and said, this isn't a significant hazard, it's not that severe, these materials aren't that bad. Not what the judge meant. Once the judge makes that finding that these materials pose a high degree of danger to the use of the escapeway, and based on the record, I think he made a correct decision, and I think his analysis was clear and well reasoned in that regard. Once he makes that decision, then you're looking at an operator who hasn't done its job in the examination, and I think what you have to have in that case is some kind of extraordinary factor of mitigation as to why, and we don't see anything like that in the record. You get back to the central point here. People are probably going to get tired of hearing me say it, but I'm not going to stop saying it. It's not the secretary's job to keep these mines safe and healthy for their employees. It's the operator's job. And the beginning of the operator's job is the examination of the mine at the periods and intervals specified in the Act and the regulations to make sure that the conditions that are likely to lead to injuries and unhealthful conditions don't exist. So that's the duty that was imposed on the operator in this case, and I don't see any justification for not taking care of that duty and ensuring that the conditions were observed and reported and that there was follow-through to take care of them in this instance. Even if you look at the possible suggestion that the conditions were not that unusual in this mine or in mines generally, if you look at it from the standpoint of it being consistent with conditions in this mine, it raises some questions about the old broken window hypothesis, where you start to tolerate things and you become inured to feeling and sensing problems that you ought to be alert to and to dangers that might be developing. But beyond that, this isn't elsewhere in the mine. This is the primary escapeway in the mine. And you really have to understand that if that escapeway is needed, you must maintain it in a condition that it can be used by all miners under the conditions you're going to encounter in a mine-wide emergency, which very often involves smoke and poor visibility, panic, fear, all of these things come into play, and you don't want to make the situation more difficult by creating an obstacle course. So, you know, I would just say, in summing up, that you can't really have circumstances where the law permits an operator to have any degree of doubt about the neglect involved, failing to observe and correct extensive and protracted existence of conditions in an escape way. And finally, there's no one bite rule failing to observe something in an inspection. I don't believe that the operator is entitled to be warned before you get an unwarrantable failure in every instance, particularly where you have something that's existed for a period of 5 weeks. There are opportunities in that period. Obviously, they're doing other things in the mine. They're constructing, the ventilation controls, and there are going to be materials around. But what you have to have is a constant understanding of the need to keep that escape way clear so that miners have it when they need it. I don't think that we could tolerate a situation where we let the operator go until MSHA points something out, for several reasons, including the fact that we've had cases, and this just drives me nuts, where the operator will come in and say, well, it was inspected 5 times and MSHA never cited the condition. And we're here looking at the aftermath of an accident at that point, and it was not cited. And those are the difficult cases that you deal with. So I can't agree with the judge's ultimate conclusion that there was a good faith belief here, because we don't dwell on a faith-based system. There's an evidence-based system, and the evidence here suggests that there were obstructions. If the judge can see it, and the judge can find that these obstructions constituted a high degree of danger, then any reasonable person familiar with the mining industry and the protective person of the standard, purpose of the standard, would have to see it also. And the fact that the examiner didn't see it in this case doesn't amount to a justification or a defense against the fact that, relative to what needed to be done in this case, this reflected a serious lack of reasonable care. Because I think this is the type of combination that couldn't be overcome, I don't see the point in remanding the issue of whether this was an unwarrantable failure for further analysis, because I don't see how you're going to overcome the findings, which are binding and conclusive right now, that the judge made in this case. So I would just reverse the judge on the finding and find that there was an unwarrantable failure and remand the case for imposition of the penalty. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Moore?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I also want to thank Stacy for her help. I've been in and out of your office several times over the past couple of weeks, and it's been very helpful to me. I have to say, on first glance at this case, the operator's argument and the judge's finding had some superficial appeal to me. I mean, the fact that they argued that they had similar conditions and MSHA hadn't cited them led them to reasonably believe that this condition in this escape way did not violate the mandatory standard. And, they're arguably analogous principles in the law, and one that comes to mind from my earlier life is in landlord-tenant law, where if somebody's rent is due by the fifth of the month, but a tenant pays for the first 6 months on the 15th, and the landlord accepts it, and then on the seventh month, the landlord says, you're out of luck, you're going to be evicted. The law recognizes that the tenant has sort of been lulled into thinking that paying late, not complying with the lease agreement, is okay. And the law will usually step in and probably using some estoppel argument, say that the tenant at least gets one bite, to use Commissioner Young's term, or at least one warning before they can be evicted. But on further reflection and legal analysis, I just don't think the argument holds up in the situation we have for several reasons. One, first, I don't think one can or should conclude that the absence of action by MSHA equates to some affirmative approval of certain mining conditions and practices. I mean, there could be many reasons why the operator is not cited for a particular condition during a quarterly inspection. There could be other more pressing issues, for example, during that particular inspection, these inspections. And so without knowing the particular circumstances during an inspection, I don't think you can conclude that the lack of a citation means that makes it reasonable for the operator to conclude that, well, this he didn't cite this condition, so it must be okay. You know, it might be different where MSHA affirmatively misinforms an operator about a particular condition, actually says, you know, says to the operator, oh, this is okay. But we don't have that in this case. This is just sort of silence or lack of action. Secondly, I looked at the record, and the company argued, I guess, about this head gate number 3, that there was a similar condition in the escapeway there, and I think we're dealing with head gate number 4. But even the judge said the conditions there weren't similar, that there were only concrete blocks, I guess, knocked out from the regular, but there was no indication that there was a pallet of cryptides or gob or water or anything else at the time the inspector went through that head gate. So it's certainly not reasonable, I think, for a company to say, well, since it was okay to have the blocks, it's okay. It's also okay to have all these other conditions. And also, it's also not reasonable for the operator to think that, well, because we have these kinds of materials in non-escapeway areas of the mine, that it's okay to have them in the escapeway, because I think everybody realizes and we can see that the escapeway is this sacred area of the mine that has to be kept safe under the standard for travel by miners, including disabled miners. And then third, and I think and Commissioner Young alluded to this, the operator has an independent obligation, you know, separate from MSHA's inspections, to abide by the mandatory standards. As Commissioner Young points out, and I never get tired of hearing him say this, the operator does have the obligation to keep its mine safe, independent of whether MSHA cites them or not. So that may be similar I think somebody pointed out to me riding down the highway and abiding by the speed limit. I mean, you might go 20 miles above the speed limit to get to work one day on time, and maybe a policeman passes you that day. But on another day, you might be pulled over for a violation because you have an independent obligation, regardless of whether that policeman had cited you in the past. And I believe under our law, the operator does have that obligation to abide by the mandatory standards. And in this case, well, not in this particular case, but in the earlier case where the judge found that the operator violated 75380D1 for failing to maintain the escapeway in a safe condition. The judge cited to a case where Utah Power and Light at 11 Femschrick 1926, page 1926, that where we held that the standard in that language in that section is, quote, clear and unambiguous, close quote. So I think based on all of this, I find the operator's belief that all of this material in the primary escapeway, the water, the concrete blocks, which, you know, there may have been as many as 25 to 35 blocks just strewn about, the gob, the take-up track, the pallet of cribs, all of this together, it's just not reasonable to conclude in and of itself, but also because they hadn't received prior citations, that this was not violative of the standard. And one thing I want to say is that one suggestion in the testimony or that particularly disturbed me was when the examiner, I think it was Dave Adams, testified that miners trying to escape from a fire or other emergency would be able to navigate over or around or through this material or impediments in the escape way by hanging on to the lifeline. And what bothers me about that is, to me, the requirement of the lifeline is more part of a belt and suspenders approach to assuring that miners are able to escape in the case of emergency. The provision of a lifeline is required so that operators, it's not there so that operators can be less rigorous in complying with escapeway standards. So I just wanted to point that out because that particular testimony, I think, bothered me when I read it. But based on all of that, I would find that the operator's belief was unreasonable. The next question is whether the case should be remanded or reversed by the commission. And as Stacy, you told us, the judge made a number of findings on three of the factors that would support a finding of unwarrantable, that it was extensive, it existed for 5 weeks, and it posed a high degree of danger. I think on these other ones, where the judge found that they were not supportive of the finding of unwarrantable, I think they were all, the foundation of those findings were based on the fact that the judge said that there was no notice of the that these conditions violated the standard, and so I think if you find that the their belief was unreasonable, that those fall as well. For example, abatement. He said that that's not supported because they didn't think there was anything they really needed to abate. But if you find that it's unreasonable for them to conclude that there wasn't a violation, then it should have been abated. Same thing with respect to knowledge and obviousness. So I agree with Commissioner Young that based on my finding that their belief was not reasonable, that we can go ahead and reverse rather than remand. So that's what I would do. And then I guess the penalty case is still pending. So.
Thank you, Commissioner Nakamura. I would agree to reverse the judge's determination that the violation was not unwarrantable. I agree with the analysis put forth by my I would note that the judge's reasoning here is inherently contradictory itself. I mean, the regulation at issue before us that we're considering that the operator was cited for requires that you record the results of each weekly examination, including a record of hazardous conditions found during each examination. So it doesn't specifically say, you know, what is a hazardous condition. So it is left to the examiner to determine what conditions need to be noted. Now, the examiner in this case said, I didn't view these objects in the escapeway to constitute hazards. the judge would have had to reject that and found that belief to be not reasonable in order to even find a violation, which he did here. So, but then when it came to determining whether the violation was a moral, the judge seemed to, you know, take an opposite approach and conclude that the examiner held a good faith belief that these conditions were not hazardous and that that good faith belief was reasonable. I think the judge's analysis was flawed, and what the law requires, what you view, is not, regardless of the belief that the examiner might have held, one has to test that belief to see if it's reasonable. I mean, as my colleagues have pointed out, there were extensive objects in this escapeway. I mean, Hemschenspecht described it as an obstacle course. True, you could literally make your way through these items, but that's not the point of the requirements that issue here. True, the examiner may have that pointed out, well, this was not much different than other conditions in the mine. I would suggest that's not a basis to avoid negligence. In fact, if an operator keeps his mind in such a state that an examiner comes across conditions that don't stand out as particularly hazardous, I would suggest that's not a reason to avoid a determination of unwarrantability. Likewise, if an examiner is trained or not trained, or an examiner is supposed to be able to recognize hazardous conditions, whether or not MSHA has in fact been in the same situation, observed those same conditions, and had occasion, unlikely for the most part, to observe the same thing and point out to an examiner that this is a hazardous condition. An examiner is supposed to be able to recognize hazardous conditions. If the examiner isn't, and the test is really what a reasonable person would determine to be hazardous conditions. And if the examiner is not able to recognize that, well, I would suggest perhaps the operator has not hired competent examiners. And again, that's not a reason to avoid an unwarrantable determination. So here, the conditions were hazardous. The judge, in fact, had to have determined a reasonable person would have found them hazardous in order to find a violation. They then existed for a period of time, over five shifts. They failed to report them. They were fairly extensive. The conditions extended in the escapeway 100 and 120 feet. And they were dangerous. I mean, they literally created an obstacle course. I would reverse the judge's unwarrantable determination. So I think, is there anything that you need to clarify now from us, Stacy? While we're here, we can speak within each other's presence. But we would encourage you to, to feel free to consult with us as you develop the draft opinion, especially like my colleague pointed out, there's not been a memorandum prepared, although I would also take occasion to thank my counsel Liz for the memos that she prepared and we shared with my colleagues. But feel free to consult with us as the drafting, if there's some question about the approach or how to lay out the analysis. Because I think the conversation has been sort of wide-ranging up here, but I think we've all reached a unanimous result. So I think it can be just taken from there. My colleagues, do you want to add anything else in terms of Stacy, in terms of drafting this?
I don't know anything to add.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I thank you, Stacy. house in it, and we will go off the record. I should start out with that.